A lot of South Florida students are headed back to school next week. A new school year also means new security measures and new focus on mental health education. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm Katie Swatulski. Tom Hudson is out this week. In the aftermath of last weekend's mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, safety policies in schools are at the top of a lot of people's minds. Here, the second school year following the Parkland shooting is about to begin. What all's changed security-wise since last year? And recently, the state announced new mental health education requirements for students in grades 6 through 12. What will be included in the curriculum? Also this week, a so-called embargo on Venezuela. How tightening economic sanctions will affect people closest to the crisis. Your phone calls and texts coming up on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. I'm Katie Swatulski, and welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Tom Hudson is out this week. Palm Beach County schools start classes come Monday. Broward County starts next Wednesday, and Miami-Dade students are back in the classroom the following week. It's the start of the second school year since the shooting in Parkland happened. The state's rolled out a new database for threat assessments, and school districts haven't been in compliance with state laws. They've had the summer to make adjustments. Yet the recent mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and in Dayton, Ohio last weekend once again bring security concerns to the forefront. Governor Ron DeSantis touched on the topics of mass shootings and school security reforms at a press conference earlier this week.
Florida has had its share, but I'm happy some of the folks from Parkland have been instrumental in pushing for some of these reforms, particularly with threat assessment, and I think that is really a direction we need to go.
Some of that new threat assessment technology comes with concerns about privacy. What do you think about sacrificing privacy for measures that are designed to increase security? Parents, teachers, and students, how are you feeling about going back to school? Marjorie Rodriguez is head of the math program at Key West High. She's been teaching for more than three decades.
It's sad that we have to be in a classroom and be thinking. We train our students. Think if something were to happen, how would you get out?
This is where we kick off the South Florida Roundup today. Join the conversation. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text to 786-786-7636. Please give your name and where you're from in South Florida. That number again to text is 786-786-7636. We're joined in studio by the Miami Herald's education reporter, Colleen Wright.
Thanks, Katie.
And also with us via FaceTime is Sonia Isger, who covers education for the Palm Beach Post. Hi, Sonia. Are you with us, Sonia? Colleen, we're going to start with you. Can you tell us more about how school districts here are addressing security at the beginning of year two since the Parkland shooting?
Absolutely. So let me talk to Miami-Dade schools first, since we are right next door. The Miami-Dade County School District said absolutely not to arming teachers or having anybody besides a sworn law enforcement officer in a school to fulfill that mandate. Remember, the mandate calls for a good guy with a gun. So that could even mean someone who isn't a classroom teacher, maybe a custodian or athletic coach, someone like that, or like a security guard or an officer. So Miami-Dade schools said absolutely not. We're only having officers. They passed a referendum last August. Miami-Dade County residents and property owners actually voted to raise their taxes. They netted, I think, about $230 million. The bulk of that actually went to charters, but about 12% or around $30 million went to funding and hiring officers for its own school's police force. So Miami-Dade schools is actually ahead of the curve because they've already had a school's police force, and they already actually had middle schools and high schools covered with an officer. And now they really just have to make up for the elementary schools. And they're pretty far along. They still have about 100 officers to hire. But even today, they swore in 45 new officers, promoted another 23, and there's another 30 in training. I believe in total that brings the total force to 400. And soon, possibly by the start of next school year, the Miami-Dade schools police force will actually be the largest schools police force in the country.
How did they get there? I mean, how did we get to have that large number of officers when other school districts are struggling to get officers?
That's a great question. The school's police department, I believe, has been around since like 1957 or so. So it's been around. It's pretty institutional. Of course, they're in a hiring frenzy right now, trying to get people. They're still getting applications, still screening people. People are still going through the academy. It's a pretty rigorous process, obviously, to become a sworn law enforcement officer. But they were pretty much, they had a huge advantage. I know Broward for some time tinkered with the idea of starting their own police force to comply with this new mandate that went into effect last year. But it's such an undertaking. You know, we're talking upwards of $20-30 million just to begin with, just to start the force. See, Broward didn't have that luxury. They just went straight into the Guardian program where, let me be specific. They've hired just kind of school security guards. They make like $13 to $14 an hour just to staff those schools. They are in the same boat in terms of they already had, for the most part, middle schools and high schools covered. They really only, and usually by other municipal police departments. So, for example, Hollywood, the city of Hollywood has staffed officers, Fort Lauderdale Police, Broward Sheriff's Office. And they do have a few school officers, but very, very, very few. But they really only had to make up for the elementary schools that were not covered. But they are required by law now to have an officer there as well.
We've got a lot to get into. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You could also text us at 786-786-7636. Please just give us your name and where you're calling from in South Florida or texting from. That's to text 786-786-7636. Sonia, we've got you on the line. I wanted to ask, in Palm Beach County, you know, what has changed school security wise from this time last year?
Well, much as Colleen has described, there's been a hiring frenzy at the Palm Beach County School District Police Department. Palm Beach County is another one of those districts in Florida that has its own police department. So I was just at a swearing in of 11 officers today. They've hired more than 100 officers in the last year. That's in addition to a force that was more than 140 already, and they're still hiring. They're hoping to hire to have a force of 240 by the end of this fiscal year. So a lot of it is hiring, just hiring, and trying to get them all through the required training.
And
the
Colleen,
other thing that's going on.
Oh no, I'm sorry, Sonia. Go ahead.
The other thing they're trying to do this year that was different is assure that every one of the charter schools in the district is manned with some sort of secure armed security on day one.
And actually, I'm curious, when we talk about charter schools, aren't they allowed to hire private security? How is that vetted?
So in Palm Beach County, yes, the charter schools have four different options, as any school district really has. They can hire a school district resource officer. They can hire, they can contract with an agency in their community. They can hire a security guard through a company, or they can, for the first time in Palm Beach County, also do the armed guardian training and train one of their staff.
And so you've actually done a lot of reporting around safety at charter schools specifically. What are some of the challenges that they're facing meeting these state requirements or choosing one of these four options to have an armed officer on every campus?
I think the biggest challenge that I hear from charter school principals is the cost. Hiring one of the school district's police officers, the school district just says, we'll let you hire one of ours, but it's going to cost you $154,000 a year.
Per officer?
I'm told. Per officer. Yeah. And the sheriff's, anybody negotiating with the sheriff's office, I've heard from principals, that's upwards of $120,000 or more. So their biggest option, their most go-to option, is a security company, and those are running in the tens of thousands of dollars also. And for a small charter school, for example, that deals with maybe 30 kids or a very small specialized group, that's a huge chunk of their budget.
And Colleen, I want to get back to the controversial Armed Guardian program. Let's listen to a clip of Key West High teacher Marjorie Rodriguez on what she thinks about school staff carrying firearms.
I would not carry a gun in school. However, there are a number of capable people in my district and particularly in my school, administrator, teachers, who could carry a gun, and I would feel a lot safer, I guess, if they did. But across the board, I'm not a proponent.
You're listening to the South Florida Roundup. We're talking about back-to-school safety and security. Join the conversation. How are you addressing gun violence and mass shootings in the classrooms? Give us a call at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text to 786-786-7636. Please give us your first name and where you're calling from or texting from in South Florida. That number again to text is 786-786-7636. Colleen, I want to ask you about the state commission that's investigating the Parkland school shooting. They're actually back in South Florida meeting in Sunrise next week. That commission's taken on a greater role in shaping the policy for local school districts. Remind us what our schools require to do exactly when it comes to safety.
So much, because the Stoneman-Douglas bill listed so many requirements, and it runs the gamut from this guardian program to having threat assessment teams, mental health. There's mental health curriculum this is more recent. This is a State Board of Education ruling that we have to do that now. There's a lot of things that have to go in compliance, as well as documenting students who have had issues. That people need to be aware of. A lot of districts have also looked at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission and looked at what the report that came out, I believe, around December or so. Miami-Dade schools, for example, led by one of the board members, Marieta Rojas, actually proposed an item to go over that and implement a lot of the things. So school districts are paying attention. They definitely do not want to be caught on the wrong foot when it comes to this. And DOE has really, kind of tightened up on requirements and regulations.
And, when it comes to what we're hearing from some teachers, like this teacher in Key West, Marjorie Rodriguez, about guns in schools and about the Guardian program, what are you hearing from other teachers in Miami-Dade and more on, are teachers feeling safer going back to school this year?
That's a loaded question. It invokes a lot of feelings, because you never think it's going to be your school. And I think what I don't want to get lost in this conversation is that schools are still the safest part for a lot of these communities. Schools are the safe haven. They are. But of course, everyone's scared that what if it's mine? There have been some people in the community who say that they don't want officers in schools at all because of relations with, students of color, LGBTQ students. They're data has shown that it's not the best setup and that there's a disproportionate amount of discipline inflicted on those kinds of students. Some people argue that. Some people do want an officer if you have to comply by this law. They'd rather have a sworn law enforcement officer than just a security guard making $13, $14 an hour, or even, being armed. If there's a teacher out there who says, and there are teachers who say, I'll carry. I don't know how many of them are in Miami-Dade. For example, the union has been adamant and on the same wavelength as the school district, saying that they don't want to be armed either. They'd rather just focus on teaching.
Well, we've actually got a caller, a public school teacher in Broward. Jennifer, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Hi, thank you.
You're on the air.
I just wanted to put my two cents in and make a comment on arming personnel on school campuses. I've spoken with my colleagues at length on this, and I would resign, and a number of my colleagues would as well, the very minute our district put any weapons in the hands of any school personnel that are not sworn in law enforcement. Wearing those two hats, nobody can do that job well. There's too many distractions. You have to be on top of your game with classroom management, as well as nurturing our students emotionally, academically, personally. And to know that one of my colleagues has a gun on campus and they are not law enforcement and they are trying to fulfill many different roles as a teacher or an athletic coach, I won't be there. And we're in a crisis right now. Teachers are quitting left and right. 30 teachers in Broward County quit yesterday. So they're going to have the county is going to have a huge drop in teacher employment if they do arm staff.
Thank you, Jennifer. I appreciate it. Colleen, when it comes to this perspective that, you know, teachers feel very strongly about this, parents feel very strongly about this, students feel very strongly about this. As we head back into year two, I really want to focus on the difference between when kids were going back to school this time last year and this year. Are there concrete things that the state or the Board of Education has done to make changes and find these loopholes?
I think this year they're focusing more on kind of ironing out any wrinkles from last year. For example, Sonia brought up charter schools and what they have to do. Apparently in Miami-Dade County, the vast majority, I'm told, from Alberto Carvalho, our superintendent, the vast majority of charter schools were in compliance, for example, with having, sworn officer. Many of them have just hired, like, off-duty officers. But it's an expense. Sonia dropped the figure that it's about $100,000. She's right. That's the figure I've heard as well, because it's not just salary. It's salary, benefits, car, weapon, outfit, uniform. And it's a lot. And this year, you know, these mom-and-pop charter schools that don't really have, like, a huge managing board, like an academic or a Charter Schools USA, for example, they struggle with the cost. And this year, for example, the Miami-Dade Police is working with these smaller charter schools. And in some cases, they're even going out of the county to get training, like Pinellas and Broward County, to maybe have just that kind of guardian option as far as the like a security guard in their schools. As far as other requirements, we have that new mental health mandate where now 5 hours of mental health training needs to be taught to kids grades 6 through 12.
We're going to get into all of that. That's coming up later on the South Florida Roundup. But I did want to ask you, Sonia, what are you hearing from teachers in Palm Beach County? Are they feeling safer? Are they seeing changes from year to year?
You know, I haven't had a lot of conversations recently. I've seen online that there's a discussion about, like, security, but mostly I think in Palm Beach County, the schools have had a long tradition of having school police officers on campus, and no one wants it to be their school, and everybody feels secure until something bad happens, and I think they're just bracing for that reality.
And Sonia, how is the Guardian program being implemented in Palm Beach County?
So the Guardian program is an interesting thing. Last year, when that first became an option, the sheriff, Rick Bradshaw, said he was not going to conduct training, so he wasn't going to train anybody to meet the requirements, which are more than 140 hours of training. This year, just a couple weeks ago, that changed, and he said, yes, I will conduct the training, and this has freed up this option for charter schools. The Palm Beach County Public Schools, however, won't be using that training because they use their own police staff.
And so, Sonia, there's this new statewide threat assessment database, and we got a text from Giselle in Miami who said, do we really have to infringe on privacy or just be more proactive about obvious warnings, like a mother calling to the police worried about her son obtaining a gun? When it comes to this database, are Palm Beach schools integrated into that yet?
It's not at all clear yet what exactly the district is sending to that state database because it is so new. I have heard the same concerns from several parents who have emailed me saying, well, if my kid's name comes up as a concern of being bullied, if he calls into the bully hotline and says, I'm being bullied, does that mean his name is going to that database? And that's something that I'm still trying to work out, and I think the district is still trying to work out exactly which data is going there.
And we learned just late last month in July that some South Florida schools were not in compliance with state security laws, did not have enough officers on campus. Have you heard of schools that are still not going to meet that deadline by day one next week?
Not in Palm Beach County. In Palm Beach County, the chief of school police is assured that every Palm Beach County school and every Palm Beach County charter school will have somebody on campus. Is that the same person who will be there 6 months from now? Maybe, hiring will change and staffing will change, but there will be someone there.
And Colleen, what do we know about Miami-Dade County schools?
As far as staffing and if everyone's going to be in compliance, you know, the charter schools, like I said, are scrambling to fulfill it. You know, I believe, like I said, the vast majority, you know, did hire those off-duty officers. But now they're seeking training elsewhere, Broward, Pinellas counties. to get that training, because it's a lot. $100,000 for a small charter school. Again, not a major kind of conglomerate chain school. You know, just these small mom and pop schools in Miami-Dade County. $100,000 is a huge undertaking. I mean, it's a huge financial burden. What we do know also is that this actually just came out yesterday. When Miami-Dade County passed that referendum last year, the superintendent Alberto Carvalho promised that the referendum funding would actually free up some of the funding from the state as far as safe school. It's called the Safe Schools Allocation. And now charter schools will actually get more of that money. About $6 million will be doled out. And they already got 20%.
Well, and still to come on the South Florida Roundup, we've been talking about school safety, but what did this year's new state requirements for mental health education look like? Your phone calls and texts here on the South Florida Roundup. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Katie Spitalski, in for Tom Hudson this week. Back to school is almost here for South Florida students, and schools have to meet a new state requirement. 5 hours of mental health training for all students at Florida public schools in grades 6 through 12. Last month, the State Board of Education voted for the mandate. The goal is to get students to learn about signs and symptoms of mental health disorders and how to get help for themselves or someone else who's in crisis. Do you think a minimum of 5 hours a year is enough? Why or why not? Sarah Maldolano is a science and writing teacher at Beacon College Prep in Opa-locka.
How can we attack mental health proactively? And I honestly feel like that's through teaching social and emotional skills that are going to help you manage and cope. Do you know about mindfulness? Do you know what it feels to be stressed? Do you know how to combat that?
We want to hear from you. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text to 786-786-7636. Please give your first name and where you're from in South Florida. That number again to text is 786-786-7636. Back in studio with us is the Miami Herald's education reporter, Colleen Wright. And via FaceTime, we have Sonia Isger. It's also still with us. She covers education for the Palm Beach Post. Colleen, I'm gonna start by asking you about this mandated health coursework. It's not new. It's not costing the state any new funding at the state's level. There's a lot of people who feel like this is really overdue. So why has mandating mental health education taken so long?
There are a lot of mandates in education when it comes to testing and certification. You know, a lot of school boards have complained, you know, is this kind of like top-down, you know, government? Sadly, I do think it took a tragedy like the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School to kind of bring this to the forefront. Why it took over a year, I'm not sure. But to go into that mandate a little bit, it's 5 hours every year for students in 6th through 12th grade. There aren't a lot of specifics. Superintendent Carvalho told me this morning that they did get some guidance from the Department of Education, that all they've pretty much said is that it has to be taught by a teacher with a certification in any subject. But that could be anything. That could be physical education. That could be health. That could be math. That could be science. One way school districts have said that they would go about this is to do like an assembly, because it's 5 hours in an entire school year. Maybe like an assembly, because, you know, the difficult part is that, you know, not all kids are in the same classes. So you might say, we might talk about it in health class. Or, for example, for the middle school students for 6th or 8th grade, they might incorporate that into PE. But, you know, there are PE waivers. Some kids opt out. You know, there are a lot of things at play. So they're still trying to figure out what that looks like. And they have until December to submit a plan to the state. And the school district actually had a bid in for mental health. The Miami-Dade County School District had a bid in for mental health curriculum. They actually took it back because now, since there's these requirements, they're reissuing the bid out. And that should be coming out soon.
And I do want to mention, I reached out to the Broward County School District, and they have not gotten back to me as of yet on what the status of that is, if there's bids out, if there's a curriculum chosen. Sonia, what is Palm Beach doing about curriculum for this? Have they purchased a curriculum yet?
They've not purchased a specific curriculum. As soon as this rule came out, I'm told that they started reviewing what they did already have in place. Like Colleen said, there's a lot of this that's taught in PE or it's taught in science class. Some of it even is touched on in like middle school literature and in high school literature when students, when you know you're trying to identify with the character and what is the character thinking, that sort of thing. But now that the state is saying you're going to have to document that you have 5 hours for every student in all, in each of those grades, they are still trying to figure it out, and they know they have until December, but they have to put something out there for the students this school year. So they think it will look something like 5 hours in one place. They just don't know where.
And charter and private schools do not have this mandate. They don't have to participate. Is that right, Sonia?
That's right.
Do we know if some are deciding to teach this anyway?
We know that the DOE says anecdotally that they've heard interest from private and charter schools, according to the material they sent out to the school districts.
And I do want to go, we've got Warren in Delray Beach. Warren, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Thank you very much for allowing me to participate. I was a student teacher. I was a substitute teacher, and of course I was a student. When I was in junior high school, we actually had a guidance class. Now, I don't know whether you mean they're going to take people one by one or have like a guidance period in school. I think 5 hours basically of guidance should impart the basics, but psychology is not an exact science. And even though I think you could take usually pretty fairly sensible young people or even older people and teach them some of the basic signs of trouble in another person, there are always going to be, I think, those seemingly quiet, taciturn people who are not showing the hostility, the hurt that's bottled up inside. And those people...
Oops, looks like we've lost Warren and Delray. I do want to mention, you've been listening to the South Florida Roundup, and we're talking about the state's new mandated mental health education. It's required for grades 6 through 12. Join the conversation. Call us. Let us know what mental health lessons do you feel are most important for middle and high schoolers to learn. You can call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text to 786-786-7636. Please give your name and where you're calling from or texting from in South Florida. That number again to text is 786-786-7636. Colleen, a lot of decision-making surrounding what actually gets taught in this new mental health mandate has been passed off from the state level to the district level. Did the State Board of Education say why they weren't interested in making a uniform curriculum? Why did they want to hand a lot of this off?
I'm going to be honest with you. State Board of Education is a whole different animal. I haven't really, been paying attention. My focus is really on the local school district. But this could be the reason why. But I know that, school boards, they're sovereign governments. They don't want to be told what their curriculum should look like. They feel like it should be on them, and it should be that decision should rest with their board. And there's 67 school districts in Florida. We happen to be in the biggest one right now in Miami-Dade County. Broward is the second. But there's a lot of smaller school district, rural, small, tiny. We're talking like 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 kids. What mental health and how they might want to do things there isn't going to be the same as what, Miami-Dade schools will want to do, maybe with size or maybe with the population. I know that Carvalho said this morning that he wants that curriculum to be meaningful and comprehensive and really inclusive. And, remember, keep in mind that we have a very diverse student population here, have a lot of poverty, a lot of trauma in these schools. And mental health goes beyond just, a mass shooting at a school. For a lot of kids right here in Miami-Dade County, it's not a mass shooting at a school. It's what happens right around it. So I believe they want to kind of frame a curriculum that also tends to those needs and is inclusive of those needs as well.
Well, and do school districts in South Florida have the capacity? I mean, you mentioned there's a lot of mandates on them already. Do they have the capacity to develop this right now?
They could develop it, absolutely. There is a mental health department in Miami-Dade schools, and some of them, put out bids, and they want to see, you know, what's the most, what's the best curriculum, the most effective, and also, you know, cost effective as well. We just have to see what comes out in the wash here in Miami-Dade.
And Sonia, I'm curious what's going on in Palm Beach in terms of is the district looking at specific curriculum? Are they thinking that, do they have the capacity to develop something like this?
Yeah, Palm Beach County is still a pretty large school district, and it has a curriculum department that is capable of pulling these disparate pieces together and putting them in one place. I think they're also interested in looking at the materials that the state will be providing. The state has said, we're going to offer up, you don't have to use it, but we're going to offer up some options. And so I think they're eager to see what those options are and find a way to make it work for them. Like, to your earlier question, I think the school, why leave it to the school districts? Each school district is so different in the state of Florida that their needs and their ability, you know, just the way they're set up is different. So what works in Palm Beach County for a schedule might not work in a smaller county or even in Miami-Dade County. So this way they can look, I think they're going to look to the state and see what the state offers up and maybe put their own spin on it or use some of it. I think the jury is still out.
We did get a text in from a Miami-Dade Public School student, Silvana. She's a rising sophomore. She says, I go to a charter school in Miami-Dade County. I know that I would not feel safe at all if a teacher or administration had a gun or another reason. If students are aware that teachers have weapons in the classroom, a student can easily grab it if it's not locked. And so she feels that defeats the purpose of armed teachers. Now, that is a whole part of mental health education. If we're adding armed teachers on top of mental health education, Colleen, what is that classroom environment going to be like?
I think it's just more of life post Parkland. You know, it's life in this era of school shootings. And it's a weird juxtaposition, right? Having guns in schools, that's a reality now, whether it's on a guardian, a non-sworn police officer or a sworn one. And then mental health on top of it. I guess I would guess that the reason why all of this is being implemented is kind of like this whole, you know, well-rounded approach, I guess. I don't know if other people would classify it as well-rounded, but I guess they're trying to tackle all aspects. And, you know, we are kind of learning as we go along. We're not really sure what works, what really prevents, what doesn't. You know, there was a school resource officer at Stoneman Douglas that day. There was a security monitor that saw the shooter come in with a duffel bag, and he knew that that student was not supposed to be there. So it's a lot of moving parts. I think everyone's just trying to implement rules that they think will keep students safe. But then there's this other argument of, is this security theater? And look at all this money that's being spent on this. Is this really making it any safer?
When we've got a text in from Ven, he says, I don't think 5 hours is enough. I think kids need to learn that people are sensitive and kids need to try to help each other and not bully each other. And so one of the things I wanted to ask you, Sonia, when it comes to this potential juxtaposition between, you know, we're talking about mental health in a classroom versus we're also talking about arming teachers, does that conflict?
Well, to be clear, we're not arming any teachers in Palm Beach County. And I think, so the question would be, you know, does school policing conflict with, you know, concerns about mental health and how children learn about that and their needs? And I don't see where there's necessarily a conflict. I don't think school police officers think there's a conflict. I think, for example, just talking to school police officers today, they know that on campus part of their mission a lot of the time is to get to know these kids and stop things from going wrong, you know, stop things from going wrong before they get too far down the line and you have something like Parkland. And it's obviously easier said than done because, like Colleen said, there was an officer there. But so the lessons that they're getting, you know, to be about bullying and about mental health have been valued for many years and probably are just getting more attention now. And
we've got a call from
so.
We've got a call from Bobby in Dania Beach. Bobby, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Are you there? Looks like we lost Bobby.
No.
Oh. Are you here?
I'm here.
Hi, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Go ahead.
Well, you have a couple of things, and they're all over the place. They are all correct. I just want to let you know that sometimes you just need to stop looking for what the process is calling and find out what other states' best practices are. I can assure you that if you look at Sandy Hook Promise, they have a fantastic mental health. And by the way, I do not agree with everything that they do. But in terms of the education from kindergarten to high school, they incorporate every single student. Let's keep in mind that in Sandy Hook, that was elementary school. So they keep all of the students, and they come back, and they do that continuous touch so everybody can come around and everybody has not only the same information, but they have the same outlet for help.
Thank you, Bobby. I appreciate it. We've been talking about mental health requirements here on the South Florida Roundup. Still to come after the break, the U.S.'s latest move against Venezuela. Is it really a full economic embargo? That's coming up on the South Florida Roundup. I'm Katie Spitalski, and welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Tom Hudson is out this week. Earlier this week, President Trump signed an executive order that's being billed as an economic embargo on Venezuela. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton spoke about the move in Lima during a meeting with representatives of 50 other nations. They discussed restoring democracy in Venezuela, which is suffering one of the worst humanitarian and economic crises in South America. Bolton said the White House is following a roadmap of the embargo that was placed against Cuba in 1962.
We're taking this step to deny Maduro access to the global financial system and to further isolate him internationally. In addition, we are sending a signal to third parties that want to do business with the Maduro regime. Proceed with extreme caution.
Is this really an embargo? The new measures actually freeze any Venezuelan government property or assets in the U.S., but there's no specific mention of trade. Policies concerning Venezuela impact the community here in South Florida deeply. What do you think about the Trump administration's latest sanctions on the country? Give us a call at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text to 786-786-7636. Please give your first name and where you're calling from in South Florida. That number again to text is 786-786-7636. In the studio with us, WLRN's America's editor, Tim Padgett.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Tim. And also with us, we've got Maye Primera. She's the senior Latin America editor for Univision.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Welcome. So, Tim, let's start with you. If you can clarify for us, what is an embargo and why does this executive order not fit that definition?
Well, an embargo in the traditional sense as we know it, for example, our 57-year-old embargo against Cuba, is when one country cuts off all trade and many other activities, for that matter, with another country, as we've done with Cuba. This really doesn't fit that description because what it does is simply re-tighten sanctions, economic sanctions that we already applied on Venezuela earlier this year, including really a de facto halt to all Venezuelan oil imports of oil from Venezuela here. And as you mentioned, it really doesn't mention trade except in the sense that it prohibits trade with the Venezuelan government, of which we really do not very much at all. And so what it does, as you said, it freezes property and assets of the Venezuelan state here in the United States, the biggest of which is probably the Citgo oil refinery company.
Well, and Maye, we don't do much trade with the Venezuelan government. Is this any way we can regulate what China and Russia are doing? That's sort of a part of this, but
yes,
do we have control over that?
Not really. I mean, the U.S. And the Venezuelan opposition is also trying to send the message that these sanctions are going to keep Russia and China far from Venezuela. But
China yesterday issued a statement saying we don't care. We're going to disregard this move. So they've already made it clear that they're going to challenge this and try to make it as moot as possible.
Well, and to sort of recap a little bit, what sanctions and steps has the U.S. government already put on the Venezuelan government leading up to this?
I mean, since Maduro is in power, they had put in place, like, sanctions against punctual functionaries from Maduro regime, no? But this is also the escalating of those steps that they already took. But it doesn't seem like they are a clear path to remove Maduro from power.
And Tim, I want to get to the significance of this for the U.S. Is it more of a PR push, or does the administration hope it will really add pressure on Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro?
Both. I think there really is a policy component here. They do hope that this will squeeze the regime in Venezuela financially sufficiently so that on top of the fact that the money is already running out in Venezuela. I mean, you look at their foreign reserves in Venezuela, they're almost depleted. So I think there is this hope that this tightening of sanctions could squeeze the Maduro regime out. On the other hand, this is very much a political move looking forward to the 2020 election. President Trump desperately needs, or thinks he desperately needs, Cuban and Venezuelan votes here to win Florida. This is a way that he can, for lack of a better word, distract Venezuelans, because they also want TPS, temporary protected status, here. They're not getting it, because if President Trump were to give Venezuelans or any other immigrant group right now TPS, it would very much anger his voter base. So in order to sort of distract Venezuelan voters here from the fact that they're not getting that kind of protected status as immigrants here, he's giving them these sort of ratcheted up moves against Venezuela to sort of give them the hope that, well, the regime's going to disappear in a few minutes.
Well, and what is the impact, other than a distraction, on these sanctions in terms of Venezuelans here in the U.S. that are in the TPS process?
Not much, really. I mean, again, as I said, the biggest effect is political. I think they're hoping that this will hearten Venezuelans into thinking that, you know, what's important is that we're really punching the Maduro regime and that very soon we'll get it out of power, so that the fact that they're not getting TPS or any other kind of immigration aid won't matter so much.
And I do want to go, we've got Riza in Miami on line one. Riza, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Hi. I'm concerned about that, right? Because I come from a family that left Cuba almost 50 years ago, and how it's affected, right? And has the embargo, just like travel bans, how it has affected mostly the people, the community that lived there in Cuba, not really the regime change. And so, to me, I'm scared. I'm afraid. I don't think that closing the borders up to those countries really made an impact in their political views. I think that it really enlightened those regimes, I guess, their propaganda. And I'm afraid. I'm afraid that this will happen with Venezuela, and I think they're being used. And the Miamians, you know, that live here, the Venezuelans that live here, I think they're being used politically, you know.
Thank you, Raiza. Maya, I want to ask you if you're hearing the same thing from others in South Florida.
Yeah, of course, even from my family. They are also scared. I mean, not just because of these specific sanctions, but because what is going to happen next. For example, if they put some prohibition in the trade. Another source of wealth in Venezuela, besides the public, I mean the Venezuelan government and the oil industry, is the money that the diaspora is sending now to those families. For example, my family that 2 years ago was able to make a living, they're not able anymore. So there is, in one hand, that fear, and in the other hand, how that word embargo sounds on those Venezuelans who have the power to vote in the next election.
Well, and Tim, there is a deep humanitarian crisis going on behind the scenes of this economic crisis. Does this quote-unquote embargo impact everyday Venezuelans living in Venezuela?
That we're going to have to see, because as I said before, this does not prohibit trade with private businesses, for example, in Venezuela. So if you're a business here in South Florida, you can still do business with a private firm in Venezuela. That's not being cut off. What we have to see, though, is how this cutoff of trade and activity, economic activity with the Venezuelan state might affect. For example, the Venezuelan state is one of the largest food purchasers in Venezuela, particularly through this program known as CLAP, which is a state-run food acquisition program. It's in big trouble. Will this exacerbate the problems with that food purchase program? So much of what Venezuela eats and does is imported. The only thing they really make is oil, and they don't even make that. They pump it. So I think there is a big fear that because so much is imported into Venezuela and the Venezuelan state has so much power over economic activity there, that eventually this kind of tightening of sanctions could hurt the average Venezuelan.
Well, and we got a text from Bill in a plantation. He says all this does is give Maduro more power to blame the U.S. for his policy failures.
Well, there is that because of the Cuba example. For 57 years, the embargo has not worked in terms of dislodging the communist regime in Cuba. What it has done is give the Castro regime, or not the Castro regime now, but that communist regime, a scapegoat, a convenient political scapegoat that many say has helped it retain power. I don't know if you would agree with that, Maya,
yeah,
or not.
Yeah, I agree. And I also will add the question about what effect is going to have these sanctions and all the propaganda that Maduro is making around it in the military forces?
Yeah,
that are actually the ones that the opposition and also the United States are trying to persuade to reveal against
right.
Maduro.
That's an
excellent
point.
What is happening there?
Excellent point she makes, because really at the end of the day, everything comes down to the military in Venezuela. If we can't convince the military to abandon Maduro and his regime, we're really never going to see any kind of regime change there. So the big question is, as she just pointed out so aptly, how does this affect the mindset of the military? Is this going to alienate them from the Maduro regime, or is it going to sort of solidify their defiance of the United States? That's what we have to wait and see.
We have Mark in Margate. Mark, are you there? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Yes, thank you. Hello. I've been listening to your conversation, and I just returned from 2 weeks in Colombia, where I met with many expatriated Venezuelans. And my comment is that any further policy such as sanctions or looking to hurt Maduro, Maduro's not being hurt. The Venezuelan people have been traumatized. And as one of your other callers was mentioning, just like the Cuban people were traumatized, Maduro is not affected by any sanctions as long as he is firmly backed militarily by Russia.
Thank you, Mark. Maye, I want to ask, the Washington Post reported that this freezing of assets in the U.S. points to the oil refinery Citgo. Tell us a little bit more about that dynamic.
Well, Venezuela, besides Saudi Arabia, I think is the only foreign country that has those kind of assets in the United States, mm-hmm. like refineries, like gas stations. So that property... it's supposed to be already in hands of the representative of Juan Guaido, the interim president that is trying to lead the country since January. No, we don't know exactly what is going to happen with these assets, but are really important not only for Venezuela but also for strategic reasons here in the States.
Thank you. We've been talking about the new economic sanctions, the so-called embargo that the U.S. has imposed on Venezuela. Thank you, Tim Padgett, WLRN's America's editor.
Thank you, Katie.
And Maya Primera, senior Latin America editor at Univision.
Thank you.
That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. The South Florida Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepery. Teresa Frontato is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Mertz. WLRN's director of radio programming and technical supervisor today is Richard Ives. I'm Katie Swatulski. Thanks for calling, listening, and sharing your thoughts. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.